but essentially it defines two different types of land owners, or land in two different types of ownerships, whether the total ownership is less than or greater than 5,000 acres. If the land is in an ownership of over 5,000 acres, it falls under a new program, wherein when the program is fully phased in, there are no privilege taxes, no severance tax, but the land is assessed for property tax purposes at 100% of its specially assessed value. As the law exists right now, land which is in a small ownership, less than 5,000 acres, the owner has an option to continue to be taxed under the current program, which puts the forest land, the specially assessed forest land values, on at 20% of their value on the tax roll, and that's the basis for the property tax. And attempts to recover that remaining 80% of value through a severance tax, which continues at 1.8%, or privilege tax, excuse me, on the east side and 3.2% on the west side. We'll get into that a little bit more later. This is what the history looks like on the western side, Western Oregon privilege tax. You note that the axes here are defined differently to try and keep the bars, you know, in the same sort of area generally. We're talking about value and volume, and in this case, if the value was $500 per 1,000 board feet, the two bars would be the same height. Okay, so what you see initially is the harvest volume out here fairly constant and then declining somewhat. But in terms of the volume that's being harvested from privately owned forests, it's fairly constant. The decrease in harvest is from public land. So you see the value of that harvest increasing rapidly here as price does approach $500 per 1,000 board feet, but then reaching a maximum somewhere around 95, 94 in terms of value, and then you see value again dropping below so that the price per 1,000 board feet is dropping, and I've just forecasted out here into the future at pretty much a constant rate. What I want to do in the next graph is to preserve this blue value line and then compare tax that view. So you start with volume, you go to value, and then finally to tax. So again, the blue bars are the same as they were in the last graph. That's the value of what's being harvested. And if the tax rate were 5%, these two bars would be the same height. So what you see in terms of the tax is a declining here as the you're starting out at 6.5% on the west side. And you see that rate declining over time until it falls below 5% and continuing to fall. And then this would be the phase-out, essentially, that's occurring under the 1999 program. The rates are lower for 3 years and then go to zero for land which is in the new program. So the only privilege tax that would be coming to the state then or would be generated is from those lands under in ownerships of under 5,000 acres where there's an election to opt into a program which you're supposed to define. Okay, but presumably they would continue to pay a major portion of their tax at the time of harvest.
We'll see.
I've got the chair confused now.
No.
Pardon. You see the same picture essentially on the east side, so I won't belabor it. Essentially harvest. The values are somewhat lower because prices are lower. They don't approach $500 per 1,000 board feet on the east side. You see the same structure again with respect to taxes, except you begin with these bars about the same height because the tax rate on the east side is 5%. But then the tax begins to drop below the value of the harvest as the tax rate falls, and again, it's forecast out here through, through 2003.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Beck.
So the tax will, the way the system is evolving, the tax will largely come due upon harvest.
No.
It's
the opposite. Most forest land is in ownerships of over 5,000 acres.
Okay.
For those lands, they move to basically a property tax only.
Right.
And that's paid annually, and it doesn't matter when they harvest.
So there is no harvest tax anymore.
For those owners.
For the over 5,000 acres.
Correct. Now, it's phased out through 2003, but after 2003, there would be no harvest tax. There would continue to be the forest products harvest tax, but there would be no privilege tax.
Okay. Another related, maybe related question. When we talk about rollback taxes on properties that have been specially assessed?
Yes.
Timber taxes?
Yes.
Are those going away? Are rollback taxes going to...
No, there's never been a
roll... What's the difference between deferred taxes and what we're talking about here?
The penalties for reclassification of land, basically taking it out of forest use, refer to the property tax, not the privilege tax.
Okay, so that's a separate category of taxes.
Right. So if you'd been zoned forest land, but specially assessed as forest land, say in near an urban area or something, and that land is assessed at whatever 20% or 75% or 100% of its specially assessed forest land value over a period of years, and then you sell it, and upon sale it's converted to say a residential use, then you go back and you look at what the tax would have been over that period had it been assessed at the residential land. And I'm not sure exactly how that penalty relation has changed over the years.
But that property tax is separate from this privilege. The deferred property tax is separate from the privilege tax. It's a separate set of tax systems.
That's correct. You know, if you go back, originally land wasn't even separated. The value of the property, including the land and the trees, was on the tax roll. Then over time, you decided, you know, that you needed a separate system for taxing the value of timber. So you separated forest land values, you put the forest land on the tax roll, and you enacted a severance tax in lieu of the property tax on the value of the timber. In 1993, the legislature said that's not right. This is an agricultural product, an agricultural process. There should be no tax on essentially the inventory of the trees. The only tax should be on the value of the forest land. So at that time, you could have put the forest land on at 100% and just exempted the trees. But that wasn't done because it would make some major shifts within the industry in terms of the tax burden relative to when you last harvested. So what was done at that time was to say, okay, we're going to take forest land, and that's the tax that we want to collect, but we're going to collect only 20% of that through the property tax. The remaining 80% we're going to collect through a privilege tax. That's where you come down to where we are.
And there were separate tax systems, but as I recall, the privilege tax, even in the statute, was stated as being intended to collect the annuitized value of the foregone property taxes that were deferred under the forest land property tax system.
It does say that.
It does say that.
Still says that.
It still says that.
So there's a connection, Mr. Chair.
It's cosmic. It's existential. It's theoretical.
All right. Well, I'll continue to absorb here.
Forest land value. Now, just quickly again, the base for the forest land for the property tax is the value of the forest land, and against that, the property tax rates apply just like they do for any other property. Now, just quickly, what's happened to that forest land base again, 1856, let's make that. Through 1955, it was all local valuation. 1955 through 57, the Department of Revenue was valuing it, and it determined it by site class. 78 through 95, the values were determined essentially following a suit by industrial landowners. It was determined by the Oregon Supreme Court, and those values were used and indexed through 1995. The index was a three-year average of the value of young growth Douglas fir. In 1995, 93 legislation actually, that put the values effective 1995 in statute. And those were indexed as 50% of a 7-year average of the Western Oregon Log Value Index. And then the 99 legislation changes that index to the Pacific Northwest Coast Lumber Index. Trying to simplify the law. Again, now I got 1856 right anyway. On the east side, same thing, local valuation, but the Department of Revenue picked up valuation in 1955 through 63, returned it to local valuation in 64, and then put it in statute in 1982. So basically, again, these values that a property tax applies to are the specially assessed value, value in forest use. On the east side, the statutory values were indexed to 50% of a 5-year moving average of immediate harvest value. And again, the 99 legislation converted that to the Pacific Northwest Coast Lumber Index. Property tax rates, I think you've seen some data on what the rates are. They're a little bit lower than you're used to here because you don't have any city rates generally in areas where you're growing trees. Now, what I've done to establish these rates is to actually go through on a code area by code area basis and weight the rates by the value of forest land in those code areas. So these reflect the tax rates that are being paid on the land where it exists, forest land where it exists. So again, you've got prime rates, 3.72 on the east side, a total of about 8.9, $8.90 per thousand. You got the local option gap, urban renewal, and bond rates on top of that for a total of about 10.4. And what you have is an offset right now, again, as part of Measure 50, the timber tax revenues that go to the districts for schools were not offset against their levy. But for non-school districts, those revenues that go to the districts reduce their levy. And that way in which that is done now, once they've got a permanent rate, is to reduce that permanent tax rate by the amount necessary to generate the revenues that they receive. So if they get $1 million in federal severance taxes flow into that district, the rate is reduced to essentially reduce the amount of revenue they generate by $1 million. Same thing on the west side. The rates are a little lower on the west side. I guess you could say that actually the school rates are a little higher and the non-school rates are a little lower. But again, the net rate about $9.18, or just a little over $9 if you take off the offset. Sort of, again, these are not easy things for me to generate, so I've got, rather than a nice long time series you can look at of how these rates have timed over time, I've got two sort of snapshots, 1991-92, and then the ones we just looked at for 99-2000. So the school rate on the east side has decreased from $16.57 to $6, essentially. Total rate from just about cut in half. And the same thing is true on the west side. This is what the, again, looking at assessed value compared to tax, we've got tax in millions of dollars and value in 100 million, so we're talking about a $10 per thousand tax rate, essentially, would make the bars about the same height. But what you notice here primarily is the growth that was occurring in the tax base when it was on at 100%. Forest land value was assessed at 100% of its specially assessed value. You saw the Measure 5 effect reducing the tax generated by that value as tax rates came down. Then in 1995, you see the forest land going on at 20% of its value. Tax rates continuing along about the same then for a while. And now under the phase-in, which is occurring under the 99 law, for 3 years, value goes on at 75% of its specially assessed value. And then finally, in 2002-2003, it goes on at 100% of its specially assessed value. And so, again, you see what we sort of expect to happen here in terms of property taxes generated by Western Oregon forest land. Same thing is true, essentially, on the east side. Again, it's more dramatic in terms of the reduction in the rates, but again, the reduction to 20% of assessed value, and that increasing back up to 75 and 100%. The exception to this is the small tract option tax, which is only about 180,000 acres. It's all on the west side. They, for years, have been under what is called a productivity value, which was determined using an income approach by the Department of Forestry. And that was supposed to include both the value of the land and the timber, discounted back to one value. And so they were taxed at 100% of that value under the property tax and exempt from the severance tax. So there was no privilege tax or severance tax on harvest in those names. So you don't see the big fall, or you would not see the big fall in terms of moving from 100% to 20%. But what happened when these values went up so rapidly was that the 97 legislature did away with forestry's job of determining the productivity values and said, conceptually, that's the same thing as we're doing with the specially assessed values anyway. So let's just get a map between forestry's site classes, which we saw 1 through 6, and the Department of Revenue's site classes, which run FA through FG, map those in and just use the department's values for the small tract option. And that's why the value drops here, is that as of 96, the values that forestry was coming up with were very high. You drop those down to what was the specially assessed value under law for the Western Oregon forest land, and the values drop. These then would not increase under the new program, but would remain at 100%, and all I've done is grow them at 3% per year, which is the limit under Measure 50. Excuse me. Let's shift now to public timberland, and again, what we're dealing with is either shared revenue or payments in lieu of tax. We don't have any taxes imposed on the federal government. State-owned land. There's two groups of land which the Department of Forestry manages. One are called common school lands, about 136,000 acres, which were retained from original land grants. Any revenue, net revenue, or any revenue generated from these lands goes directly into the common school fund. And right now, the way that this, there's been some change over time, but right now, the cost that forestry incurs in managing these lands is taken out of the earnings of the Common School Fund. So all the revenue from the sale of timber goes from these lands, goes into the Common School Fund. Forestry's costs are paid out of the Common School Fund earnings. The other big group of lands, which is about 654,000 acres, are lands which were initially privately owned, and the counties foreclosed on for lack of payment of taxes, and eventually deeded over to the state with two understandings. One was that the state actually incurred the cost of reforesting those lands, and secondly, that the state would share revenues from those lands with the counties in the future. The current distribution, or the way this is working currently, is that forestry is requiring about 36.25% of the revenues from these lands for their management plans and activities associated with operating those forests. The remaining 63% goes back to the counties. And it's not exactly clear how, I can't tell you exactly how much goes, it varies by county, I can't tell you exactly how much goes with to each function. What the law says is that the counties will be fully reimbursed for any management costs associated with those reserves. But not less than 10%. So they get some amount. Anyway, whatever's left over after the counties take their bite, the balance is distributed 25% to the county school fund, and 75% goes back to all districts, proportional with their tax rate. So this is going back to the counties where these harvests occur, not all counties, okay? And some of that additional, depending on the county tax rate, some of that money could also flow back to the county. this is what the revenues look like from the common school lands. This is not the distribution now, but the revenues that flow into the common school fund. And this is the revenues that are essentially generated by the Board of Forestry Lands, which go back to the counties. Again, substantial amount of money, some variation, and we see what we expect to be an increasing trend here. Forestry has, as I understand now, sort of come to an overall agreement about management plans, but has not been able to come up with a harvest plan associated with those new management plans. So a little hard to forecast exactly what this is going to do in the future at this point in time. U.S. Forest Service, again, the revenue is county revenue. A 1908 law dedicated 25% of timber sales to the counties. When harvest began to decline seriously in the late 80s, early 90s, I guess, because of the Endangered Species Act, the Budget Reconciliation Act of 1993 produced guarantees for certain forests affected by the spotted owl. And these came into effect and sort of preserved the historical distribution, although they phased them down over time. And then finally, the most recent legislation that's passed now in Congress guarantees the counties 85% of the highest of 3 years between 1984 and 1995, and then it does index that. And the important thing is that it applies to all reserves, not just reserves affected by the spotted owl. The dedication is that 75% goes to the county road fund and 25% to the county school fund, and that is included in your state school fund distribution formula. I noted that there were exceptions. Several eastern Oregon counties have the authority to move some of their road funds to the county school fund, but I don't think much is going on. These are not levy offsets. These are budget resources to the local districts. Here's what it looks like over time. The top of these bars essentially is the total amount of money, and then I've tried to divide it up. This is the yellow is what they get under the 25% guarantee from 1908. The blue is what they get through 99-2000 under the Endangered Species Act, and thereafter what they would have gotten. However, that act is replaced by House Resolution 2389 so that they get the total amount from that federal legislation above the 25% now is guaranteed by the 2389. And this runs out through 2006. I've run it out through 2002-2003. Bureau of Land Management is similar. Rather than 1908, the initial revenue sharing legislation was 1937. That guaranteed the counties 50% rather than 25%, 50% of the revenue from harvest off of Bureau of Land Management managed lands. And again, the spotted owl guarantees had the same effect on these harvests as they did for the U.S. Forest Service harvest. And House Bill 2389 applies equally to Bureau of Land Management lands. Dedication of these is all goes to the county general fund, and there's no levy offset. So these monies are not divided between the school district and the road fund. Again, they look similar, and again, the initial 50% guarantee is in yellow, the Endangered Species Act in blue, and the new legislation in red. The other forest that's involved and actually managed by Bureau of Land Management is the Coos Bay Wagon Road, which involves two counties, Coos and Jackson. This was missed in the 1937 legislation relating to the Oregon and Nevada, Oregon and California railroad lands, and it was picked up in 1939, but by that time, the federal government decided that the basis should be payment in lieu of property tax rather than sharing revenues. So what they actually do is set up a commission and they decide, you know, we talked about how you pay the severance tax if you harvest from private land. And that involves getting the logs scaled, going down, getting them scaled, finding out how many thousand board feet of each species and grade has actually been removed from the property. Well, they don't do that on federal land, so they had to set up a separate commission to determine how much was harvested. Anyway, they do that, and they try to figure out exactly what the tax on that would have been had it been harvested from private land. And that's what they pay instead of sharing revenues. The latest legislation, House Bill 3389, also applies to these lands, and it guarantees, again, 85%, but it's 85% of those in lieu payments that occurred between 1984 and 1999. Dedication, again, is county general fund. There's no levy offset, and as you can see, most of the revenue goes to Coos County. And we're talking in general around $600,000, but the guarantees here under the new legislation will increase my estimate, and this is very unclear looking at the law exactly what it does, but it will substantially increase those revenues going to Coos and Douglas counties. Forest product, this is the last group here. Forest products harvest tax. This is a separate tax. It's not on the value of the product harvested. It's on the same trees, but it's on more trees than the privilege tax because it applies whether it's publicly or privately owned land. Any harvest, essentially, with certain exceptions, we'll get into with the bills, is subject to the forest products harvest tax. It began essentially in 1985 with funding for forest research. And then with the Department of Forestry, a number of activities of different sorts have been funded through this. The main one, however, is to fund up to 40% of the cost of administering the forest products harvest tax. And that's one of the bills that we have today, is essentially whether to continue that or not, as well as the research. There was for a while an industrial fire program funded out of this, but that sunsetted in 1995. There have been various studies, such as salmon and cumulative effects of harvests in the various watersheds that have continued since 1991. And past last session is assistance to non-industrial landowners by the Department of Forestry. All of those activities then are funded to the extent indicated by the Forest Products Harvest Tax. Again, in 1986, Forest Products Harvest Tax was used to partially fund fire suppression, the Oregon Forest Landowners Protection Fund. In 1991, the industry itself sort of used the state to impose a tax on itself for the Forest Resource Institute. And I think that's, for a brief period, 11 months, the industry agreed as part of, again, the watershed and salmon problem to impose a tax of about $1.75, which is a substantial tax. But in the bill, there was the condition that it would the tax would go away if the salmon were listed. They were listed as a endangered species, I think. Anyway, it met the conditions of the bill, and the tax went away. Here's what the tax looks like. In terms of revenues that have been generated over time. And again, the revenues here reflect all kinds of changes because the way in which these taxes are set generally is to decide what the budget is for the program and then to fund it. So depending upon what the harvest is, depending upon the tax rate, the revenues vary all over the place, so you can't really tie it to harvest or tie it to value or anything. There's a lot of things that are changing. The current rates, let me go back a slide for a second. Current rates right now for research are 67 cents, and then for those activities here other than assistance, the rate for assistance to non-industrial landowners is 15 cents. For these other activities under the Department of Forestry, $1.08. Fire suppression for, again, the state forester has the authority to suspend the forest products harvest tax in any year where the forest land, where the estimate is that the forest land, the balance in the Forest Land Protection Fund will be over $15 million. And so that has been suspended for 2001. So for 2001, the rate is zero, but the rate in statute is 50 cents. And that will normally be the case unless that fund balance is estimated to exceed $15 million for the upcoming year. The rate for the Forest Institute is 79 cents. So the total rate right now is $2.69 with a zero forestry rate, or $3.19 with a 50 cent forestry rate. And that basically concludes.
Thank you, Dick. Any questions for Dick before we get into the bills? All right. Yeah, that's fine. Why don't you come on up here, Dick? You can. Yeah, do you have the center sheets? Here they come. Thank you very much. Let's see, I'm looking here. I've got some folks from out of town. I want to make sure we get those bills heard today. Let's begin with a hearing, public hearing on House Bill 2157. I'll do that. That's top of the agenda. I'll open the hearing on House Bill 2157, and Dick, if you can give us the overview on that.
As the materials that you have before you indicate, the bill comes having passed out of Agriculture and Forestry, 7 yay and 2 excused. There is the third sheet in your packet. It has kind of a summary that I just kind of wanted to go through because the statutes are a little bit convoluted in the sense that they refer back and forth to a number of provisions. What you have basically, what the bill refers to is basically a farming operation which involves growing hardwood to produce a pulp product of furnish to be used in a papermaking process. And so you have the establishment essentially of this, the conditions which are necessary to meet to qualify, and it might be worth just briefly looking at those in essentially lines 14 through 21 of the bill. It says, except as provided in 321.274, and we'll look at that in a moment, but basically it's a hybrid cottonwood which are grown or growing on land which has been prepared by intensive cultivation methods, which is cleared of competing vegetation for at least 3 years after tree planting. And it's of a species marketable as a fiber for inclusion in the furnish for manufacturing paper products. And it's harvested on a rotation cycle within 10 years currently, and all this bill does essentially is to increase that to 12 years. And it's subject to intensive agricultural practices such as fertilization, insect and disease control, cultivation and irrigation. So I've tried to outline here on this one sheet, the election simply says if you take the reforestation tax credit, which is another bill we have before us here today, if you, as an owner, and you want to start one of these operations and you convert essentially underproductive forest land, and you take the tax credit for that purpose, then you are electing by doing that to be taxed as forest land. In any other event, if you meet the qualifications that we went through here, you're taxed as farmland, essentially, as under the provisions here of the short rotation hardwoods. And what that does in 321.005 is it exempts any harvest of those cottonwood fibers, timber, from the forest products harvest tax. It puts the land on as farmland, and it exempts the harvest from the privilege tax in eastern and western Oregon. Now, it would be exempt, you know, forest land, again, how it's treated under current law depends on how big the ownership is. So if it's, if we're talking about ownerships of over 5,000 acres, then the effect of this is to change the assessment from 100% of forest land value to farmland value. And in either case, you'd be exempt from the privilege tax. But the main difference remaining then is whether or not you pay that $3.19 that we were talking about in terms of the 1,000 board feet forest products harvest tax.
All right. Okay. Let's bring up Chip Craig then. And Don Rice, why don't you come on forward too? And welcome both of you. Mr. Craig, I'll let you start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Chuck Craig with Department of Agriculture. House Bill 2157 is brought forward by the Department of Agriculture at the request of industry. It is a housekeeping bill, and the origin of it goes back to the 95 session of the Oregon Legislature, which amended the Forest Practices Act to extend the period of time that hardwood poplars, hybrid poplars could be grown and be exempt from the Forest Practices Act from 10 years to 12 years, in effect classifying those as an agricultural operation for two more years. Corresponding tax statutes were not changed at that time. The basis for that two-year extension, I think, was perhaps twofold. One was that the grass seed industry was investigating and funding research into the growing of hybrid poplars on lands in the Willamette Valley, which were heavy clay soils. And the finding was that it might take a few years longer for the trees to reach an economically harvestable value at that time, and also the pulp market was soft, and as sort of a defensive move, the industry needed a couple years of additional flexibility. So our purpose in bringing this bill forward really is to provide for the producing of poplars up to 12 years consistently as agriculture. And
so I understand the 12 years was provided for in 95 legislation?
It was passed in 1995, and then it was subsequently ratified by the 96 special session.
I'm just curious, what's taken us 6 years to get around to reconnecting the tax code with the rest of the statutes?
Mr. Chair, I can't answer that. I received a communication about a year ago from two people in the poplar industry saying, we noticed that tax code hadn't been changed. We thought all this had been changed. Shouldn't this be made consistent? We looked at it and said, yeah, we think probably should be.
I wonder if it's not that poplar trees and these hybrid cottonwood trees knew enough that people are beginning to look to the end of, just now beginning to look to the end of that 10-year rotation.
Very well may be that the spurt in planting occurred about 10 years ago. So,
okay. Questions for Mr. Craig? All right, Mr. Rice, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Don Rice from Greenwood Resources. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just support the concept of clarifying this language. The idea of agricultural exemption really isn't the point of the change in the bill. It's really a change from 10 to 12 years only to clarify the statutes. But the discussions and the investigation into the ag versus forestry status has taken place a number of times over a number of years previously, and I'd be glad to try and add any history to that if there's questions how we got to that, but I don't want to belabor the point. So primarily I would speak in favor of the bill as a clarifying motion, and it's really not a dollars and cents tax issue to the growers, but a consistency issue amongst the legislation. Largely, we've looked at if you're either cleanly ag or cleanly forestry, there's not a big difference in dollars as long as you don't, you know, get taxed on both sides of the street.
Okay, questions for Mr. Rice. Representative Beck.
I'm not sure who this is for, Mr. Chair, but since we're talking poplars, and I've always been struck at the volume of cottonwoods or poplars being grown in Umatilla County in an arid climate. I don't know if any of you have seen it. It's pretty dramatic. My understanding is that these are pretty water, this is a pretty water intense operation. I'm wondering whether the adoption of these provisions in 95, I guess, have sort of been responsible for promoting growth of these types of trees in an arid climate, whether that's appropriate or something we should be thinking about. Do we treat Eastern Oregon versus Western Oregon differently for kinds of trees? Either of you, this is a general question.
Well, maybe I can speak to the water use issue to begin with, if I could, Representative Beck. When you look at what the sites were used for prior to planting in poplar, a variety of agricultural crops, alfalfa, hay, et cetera, basically all those crops are a total canopy crop, and the poplar is a total canopy crop when it reaches a certain age. And so, for instance, early plantation, you may only use 18, 20 inches of water a year, where in an agricultural crop, you might use 36 to 48 inches a year. But then when the poplars mature and occupy the whole site, then they're also using the same amount of water as the alternative that they came from. So in terms of total water usage across the landscape, it may even be less than the other usage. Another point to your question?
No, I was just kind of curious as to whether this body of law here was part what, whether this tax treatment for these types of agricultural use is what has spawned these crops in Eastern Oregon. It was just
The tax issue, as I indicated earlier, it really isn't a dollars and cents significant difference one way or the other.
One other separate question. If someone, I notice in the statute it talks about a species marketable as fiber for inclusion in the furnish for manufacturing paper products. If someone decides to convert a cottonwood or poplar farm into a furniture business, they decide that they can make more money, are they affected by... Do they still get the tax treatment that we're providing?
The guidance that we've received so far is that the language is in front of me is such as suitable for furnish in paper products or something like that. It doesn't say it has to go there. And even if you harvest today a percentage of your plantation for other products, in all probability, you're still going to have a significant portion that's going to go for pulp and paper furnish. Smaller stems, tops, etc., will continue to go into that market.
Okay.
So what we've been counseled so far is that that's not an issue.
More a matter of the suitability of the species as opposed to your actual market when you harvest it.
Right.
I guess if I might, Mr. Chair, that was the one issue that sort of concerned me in terms of the economist and tax theory, is that if, to the extent that the product does move away from the furnish and into the furniture market or some other market, it's competing with other forest land, which is taxed as forest land, which does pay the forest product harvest tax.
So are you speaking against the bill?
No, certainly not. No, I would not do that.
That's theoretical.
But, tax theory is concerned about government taxes interfering in markets. And that's the concern here, is whether or not you compete, you create two people who are competing and they're on different tax, significantly different tax burdens.
If I could, most of the comparison that we've looked at historically has been the use of the land and, you know, what is the land used for? You know, is it farm ground? Is it flat? Is it tillable? You know, what's the practice used? Do you control weeds? Do you cultivate? Do you do all those types of things as to determine the, you know, kind of ag versus forestry feel to the whole thing. And the product that it's gone to at the end hasn't been a big focus historically.
Mr. Chair, if I might just add a comment to that. I think if we were talking about more than 2 years, I'd probably have a lot more interest in this argument. But I think that if you start out producing for the pulp market in the first place, you're going to have a narrow spacing of trees. And I don't know that you're going to gain that much in terms of growth in a two-year period. So I tend to think it's a theoretical sort of thing that you might watch if we were here asking for it to be extended to 15 or 20 years.
Well, if we were doing that, we'd be looking at the underlying legislation,
yeah,
too.
Right.
So, okay. Thank you very much. Let's bring up Dave Nelson.
Well, Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Oregon Seed Council, and through field burning fees provided much of the research money to develop hybrid poplar as a potential rotation crop here in the Willamette Valley. And in 1995, it was our organization that asked the Senate Natural Resources Committee, Agricultural and Natural Resources Committee, chaired by Senator Bob Kintai, to extend the 10-year period to 12 years. Actually, we asked him to extend it to 15 years for under the concern that some of our people would be growing hybrid poplars and the market would soften. They would be put off from harvest for an extended period of time and wind up being caught under the provisions of the Forest Practices Act, which require them to do such things as leave 2 trees per acre forever and totally ruining, you imagine, a 100-acre field with 200 trees spaced out through it and trying to farm around that. So we made that request, got into an enormous Donnybrook with the forest industry over the applicability of the Forest Practices Act and us tinkering around with it, and compromised at 12 years. We didn't compromise. That's all we could get. So now come back to you through the Department of Agriculture and say, as the chair asked, why didn't you come back earlier? Well, after the 95 experience, we didn't want to be back much earlier tinkering around with forestry stuff. So we're here again saying it makes sense. As what we had been concerned about was that the pulp market softened. We have seed growers who planted 40 acres of hybrid poplars who are, their contracts are being put off saying we don't need it now. So asking that be extended for a two-year period of time so that it matches up with the Forest Practices Act. And frankly, I don't see don't think that you'll see many grass seed growers getting into the hybrid poplar business again in the future. I think to Representative Beck's question, and I think as I was told by my friend Ray Wilkinson, that if you look on Section 2, Subsection 5, that says if you use the wood for other than pulp, then these exemptions disappear.
Okay. Thank you very much. Gene Wilkinson and Ken Falk, let's bring you up together.
Good afternoon, Representative Shetterly, members of the committee. My name is Jean Underhill Wilkinson, and I'm with the Oregon Farm Bureau. We are here today in support of House Bill 2157. I'm interested in learning a lot more about the poplar farming that's going on around the state. I don't know a lot about it so far, but it's a very interesting issue. But generally speaking, if farmers can find a crop that they can be paid for, which is not common nowadays, and they can make money from that crop, alternative crops, we are generally in support of that idea. It seems to me that House Bill 2157 generally provides consistency among the statutes, so I don't think it's a real substantive change that we need to be concerned with. But I can understand that in the future, if these poplar trees are left longer and potentially those trees are cut and used as lumber, in the future, if that occurs, then I'm sure players will want to start discussing how those trees are, how those plantations are governed, how they're taxed, and how they're regulated. And the Oregon Farm Bureau would be interested in participating in those discussions in the future. I have sitting beside me Ken Falk. He's with the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, and maybe he can tell you a little bit about himself and make a few comments.
For the record, my name is Ken Falk. I'm a small woodland owner in southern Benton County and a second vice president with the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. Our legislative committee took a look at this bill when it was first introduced here at the start of the session, and we did not support it, but we did not oppose it. The discussion around the table with the committee could have been echoed what you heard here today. At some point, 15 years, whatever, 20 years, surely that wood would be big enough that it would probably be competing with our softwood in some of the markets, and we'd want to take a real serious look at it then. Representative Beck, I had the same feeling. I hadn't been to Eastern Oregon for quite a while, and last summer I had occasion to go to Pendleton, and suddenly there in Umatilla there was a forest, and and they had a row cut through it. It was a tunnel that you could, and as far as you could see, there were trees. And someone in the van said, yeah, there's 800 acres in this block. And as a forester, things, started, wow, this would be a whole research study. What have the animals done? I mean, the black-tailed deer here in the valley just love hybrid poplar leaves. They'll stand on their hind legs to reach it. And the prey-predator relationship, the coyotes, have they changed their habitat? Their habits. And hunting in this forest now instead of on a rangeland or whatever it was. But again, that has nothing to do with this bill. It is something to look at in the future because it is no longer a rangeland. It's a forest. But we do not oppose, Oswald does not oppose this bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions for these witnesses? Does anybody else wish to testify about House Bill 2157? That's not signed up. That takes care of everyone who is. Okay. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2157 and go ahead and open a work session on that. Much pleasure.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I move House Bill 2157 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Representative Witt moves House Bill 2157 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Please call the roll.
Representative Kay.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Half.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
Yeah.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Carlson.
Aye.
Safari.
Aye.
Aye. And Bates is excused. House Bill 2157 goes to the floor with a due pass. Do we have a carrier? I was looking down here.
I would do that.
Representative. All right. Look at that. Take care of that. Let's go on to House Bill 2161. Open a public hearing on that.
Now, Mr. Chair, I referred earlier to a reforestation tax credit, and this is this bill addresses the existing reforestation tax credit. The credit is essentially designed to encourage people to take land which they own, which is poorly stocked, and to cut what's there, replant, and essentially convert it to a satisfactorily stocked forest property. And what this bill does with respect to that credit is to remove the sunset. The credit is paid in two parts. When the state forester pre-certifies essentially that the conditions have been met as far as planting the land, they're entitled to 15% of the cost that are incurred to do that. About 2 years later, when the state forester then certifies that sand is free to grow, they get the other 15%, plus qualified management costs that they've incurred during that 2-year period. As I said, the credit was, in this form, 30% total, was first amended in 1987 to that form and sunsetted in 1990. And that's the sunset you see being removed in Section 3 on page 3 of the bill. The last thing there is to repeal Section 5, Chapter 605, Oregon Laws 1987, and that's the sunset on this provision, which is 1990. The actual sunset is 2001 now because it was extended in 89 and also extended in 95. Again, the bill comes from Agriculture and Forestry. There was, in this case, one dissenting vote. As it came out of that committee, it was 6-1-2.
Madam Chair?
Representative Witt.
Thank you. Dick, I'm sorry, did you say Section 3 is where the sunset is repealed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I did.
Okay, so we're ready for your testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Ray Craig and Wally Rutledge. Let's start with you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ray Craig, Assistant State Forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry, and with me is Wally Rutledge, who is the Program Director for the Forestry Assistance Program. This is one of two programs, this particular bill addresses one of two tax programs that the Forestry Department administers, the other one being the Western Oregon Small Tract Optional Tax. And Wally will provide the substantive testimony on this bill today.
Thank you, Ray. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Wallace Rutledge, and I'm Director of Forestry Assistance with the Department of Forestry. Dick's explained the bill a little bit to you. Actually, it does one other thing other than eliminating the sunset date, and that is closes a loophole in which landowners will not be able to claim a tax credit for financial assistance being provided to them by the state or other government agencies. The bill actually covers that, or we thought it covered that, where it says that cost share is not eligible for tax credit. We have a Forest Resource Trust that was passed by the 1993 legislature. That particular program says it's a financial assistance, and that is not covered under this present tax credit bill. And so by inserting the words financial assistance or other incentive program, then landowners cannot use cost share or other financial assistance or incentives to claim a tax credit on. I'd like to call your attention just a little bit to the importance of this program. Now, Dick already explained that generally these lands are poorly stocked lands. They do not have a manageable stand of timber on them now, or they are pasture land, or their lands are covered with Scotch broom or blackberry or something like that. Those lands are very expensive to convert to healthy productive forest. And so what this bill does is it allows the landowner to make that investment and convert those lands to manageable, productive, healthy forest. And I've had a lot of landowners that tell me that without this tax credit, they wouldn't be able to afford to do that. If you look at the charts that are part of the handout there, attachment 2 has the number of acres over the years that this program has been in effect since 1979. And as you can see, as the program was amended, it started out as 10% tax credit to landowners from 10 to 500 acres. Then it was amended to 10% to 2,000 acre ownership, then it was amended to 30% tax credit at the same acreage, and then in 1991, it was amended, no, it was 89, it was amended to include all acreage, 5 acres and larger. And that's when the industry started converting some of their lands, and there was a dramatic increase. Now, as you notice, the last two biennial, there's been a fewer acres being converted. That's primarily due to stumpage values and pulp prices. This thing really kind of mirrors that market, because if the landowner can't get anything for his pulp or the little bit of wood that's on the acreage, then even with a tax credit, they're not able to convert some of these acres. The attachment 3 shows you the dollars of tax credit over the life of the program, and here again, as you notice, the last two biennial, those tax credits kind of leveled out. About $785,000 in 95-97, and about $776,000 in 97-99 biennium. So here again, the program's kind of leveled out. We've estimated for the next couple of biennial that, or at least for this one, it may be a little less in terms of tax credit because of the market conditions. So I would urge you to pass this bill and eliminate the sunset on this very important tax credit program for small landowners. It has been sunsetted for a number of years. It's a very good program. It works. And so we'd like to see that sunset removed. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions for Mr. Rutledge? Representative Williams.
Mr. Rutledge, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rutledge, I'm just interested in if you could maybe explain why prior legislatures in, what was it, 89 and 95, chose to continue to just renew a long sunset as opposed to actually remove the sunset.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Williams, I think, not knowing exactly how the legislature thinks, but I think it was because this program was instituted in 79. It's been changed a number of times over the past several years, and now the program is basically a good program that works, and so we think now it's time to eliminate the sunset and move on in a permanent situation.
Good. So what you think was going on was that it was not functioning as well, and so they were hesitant about making a program that might not have been functioning permanent, but it's your belief now that it's sort of hit its stride, and I want to make sure I'm understanding what I think you said.
Chair Chedley, Representative Williams, I believe that to be the case. As you can see from the charts here, there wasn't much participation in it when it was at 10%. Then we moved it to 30%, and that increased it a little bit, but then we moved it to allow any forest landowner with more than 5 acres, and then there's considerable increase in the amount of participation. Interesting enough, over the last two biennia also, we've noted that there's about an equal number of acres being converted by both the industry and the small woodland owners.
One other point I think relevant to that, there was a lot of uncertainty as to whether or not opening Pandora's box when it was essentially open to the industry. So you not only put a sunset on it, but you capped the amount that the that forestry could actually issue in the way of preliminary certificate. So you got that guarantee in addition as to whether or not this thing might balloon into something much larger than expected.
Representative Beck, you had a question.
Yes, I want to get at, we've talked about tax credits one of our sessions. Is there a value, a dollar figure that we have? Is it
we have a revenue impact statement on this showing $67,000 for the current biennium and $350,000 after that and $600,000 after that.
Okay. I'm wondering, at what point have we accomplished our goal? Is this, my head has evolved into the benchmark realm. Do we think about this kind of program in terms of a set of goals every couple of years and what threshold the tax credit should be to achieve that benchmark in terms of reforesting these difficult acres?
Chair Shetley, Representative Beck, we've given that some thought, and there's been a lot of discussion about maybe we should increase the tax credit to, say, as much as 50%. To give you an idea of the magnitude of the problem, there's about 1.5 million acres currently that could qualify for this program. We have a good inventory of about 500 acres of those in Western Oregon. So I guess to answer your question, there is some people think we need a greater tax credit in order to accomplish the goal of the, I would say that of the 1.5 million acres, that if we could reach half of that, that we would be doing a good job for the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If it, based on the charts, the dollar charts, I mean, where are we? I mean, how much progress have we made in, 5 years, and how much do you expect to make under this 30% tax credit in the next 5 or 10 years? And I'm just kind of curious as to, have we made progress relative to that 1.5 million acres? Where are we? Where were we? Where are we going?
Representative, our Chair Shetterly and Representative Beck, we've, since 1987, the total is about 49,000 acres that we've converted. Okay. Prior to that time, for the 9 years when it was 10%, we only accomplished about 5,200 acres.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't made as much progress as we'd like. There's no question about that. I think in order to make much greater progress, we probably would need to increase the amount of tax credit because, like I mentioned earlier, even with the 30%, if the market isn't fairly high in terms of stumpage values and pulpwood values, a landowner still can't afford to do some of this work. And you'll be hearing some testimony a little later on about what it costs to convert some of these forest lands.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rutledge, if I understood your testimony there in responding to Representative Beck, you think this program might work more effectively if we increase the percentage of the credit to 45 or 50%. Is that correct?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Witt, yes, that's correct. That's what I think.
Okay, would the department support an increase in this credit to a higher figure? I mean, does that make sense over the longer term in terms of getting more of this land productive?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Whip, yes, the department would support that.
Okay, in your written testimony, this may be just a technical point, but I want to make sure I understand this correctly. Your written testimony on the first page, the 1, 2, 3, 4th paragraph down, you have, if midway through that paragraph, says, if so, landowners can claim 15% of the credit in the first year. You mean 15% of the cost, don't you?
Yes. Chair Shetterly, representing
the credit.
Yes, it's 15% of the cost as the credit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Finally, Mr. Chair, if I can follow up.
Yes,
one more
sure.
question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that this, in view of the reduction in federal land and timber on federal land being available for harvest compared to 10 or 15 years ago, is this a good policy consideration to get more private land in good condition so that it can give us higher harvests and higher yields? And does this bill help accomplish that?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Witt. I believe that it's very important that we get more of these lands converted on the private sector in order to help make up some of that the harvest that we're losing on federal lands.
Okay, thank you.
Technical question. Dick, did you say that it's capped at 1.1 million? Is that?
Yes.
Is that in the statutes already somewhere? I didn't see it in
108, I believe it is. 315-108. If you're looking at the statutes, let me make sure that's correct.
That is correct.
Yeah. And there wasn't a period of time where they looked at what the actual was and determined that as a limit for 1 year, and then the limit became twice that annual average, and that limit has been effective since January 1 of 1997. And the number that forestry has determined in terms of what was actually credited or the credit that was issued during that period was is in the notes here at 1.142 million.
Per year?
Yes. That's what they can certify.
And that limits, you know, there's if you don't get preliminary certification, there's no final tax credit. So it limits the flow into that program.
Well, Mr. Chairman, yes. The question would be then, is there a mechanism then if you get, you know, first come, first serve,
yes,
approach, if you get a bump up against that ceiling?
Chair Shetterly, Representative House, yes, it's the first come, first serve.
Anything else for these witnesses? Okay, well, thank you. We've got a couple more, if we can finish the testimony on this bill. We've got some witnesses from out of town. I'll bring them up together, if I may. Next, Mr. Carr, Donald Carr, and Ken Falk, will bring you back up, and Phil Adams. Oh, let's start on this end.
For the record, my name is Phil Adams. I'm a management forester for Lone Rock Timber Company in Roseburg, Oregon. Appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I do apologize. My written testimony, my secretary called in sick today, and so I'm hopelessly inept without her and didn't get a chance to change the cover, so accept my apology. Wanted to talk today and give you a perspective from the small industrial landowner perspective. Lone Rock Timber owns about 80,000 acres in Douglas and Coos County. Of that 80,000 acres, we've identified about 10,000 of those acres that would meet the qualification standard of this 30% tax credit. To date, we've, from 1990 to date, we've been able to, with your help and the tax credit's help, convert approximately 5,000 acres of those, of that backlog. And that's about a $2.7 million investment, of which we've been able to receive $80,000 or $800,000 of tax credit in both initial and final certification. And so we still have approximately 3,000 acres left to convert. And as we were talking earlier, depending on market conditions and available investment dollars, it is our goal to operate on 200 to 600 acres annually. Mm-hmm. And that's where the 30% tax credit does come into effect for us. It offers that ability to schedule this kind of work in conjunction with our other type of reforestation operations. The other important part is that with the 30% tax credit in place, we're able to really think about investing in underproductive lands that either through purchase from landowners that just do not have the technical expertise that we do or the financial horizon or to invest in. And the complex, it's a complex process of reforestation. And the land bases out there, as Mr. Rutledge alluded to, in 1991, we've been following the Department of Forestry study, and they indicated 313,000 acres in just our working circle. So the acres are out there to look at and invest in. Just to get you up to speed on the conversion process, if you're unfamiliar with it, it is different than typical conifer site conversion or reforestation. The conversion process is much more expensive, and you have to focus in different areas of the reforestation cycle to be successful. First part of the process is salvage log and any merchantable hardwoods or conifer that are on the site, Generally, these volumes and values are very low, so logging costs are extremely high relative to final harvest of a conifer site. After logging, if that's part of your prescription, it needn't necessarily be part of the prescription, by the way. You have to prepare the site for planting using herbicides, fire, brush piling, and or subsoiling in various combinations. We've got examples of sites where we've used all these tools together. Plant large vigorous seedlings, very crucial part. And that gets you to basically, you have to spray and provide for vegetation management until the seedlings are established and vigorous. The first three get you through basically primary certification. Four and five get you to final certification. The standards and the standards of qualification are high. The state is a very tough and demanding partner. So you have to produce a very high quality final product to get certification. Economics, and this is where the rubber really hits the road for landowners. The financial resources to convert underproductive land are very substantial. And the payoff is a long way off. The challenge is it takes a good deal more expertise, effort, and expense to regenerate hardwood or brush-dominated sites that when compared to a conifer site. We tracked this really hard when we started really getting active in the program, and using some data that we generated in 1993 comparing some conifer site work and hardwood and brush work, we determined that a good rule of thumb is it's going to cost $480 to $500 an acre to operate on brush field and hardwood sites compared to about $250 an acre to get to the same spot for a conifer site. Certainly these costs are not going down. They continue to rise during one period. If you looked at our whole larger picture program from 1990 to 1997, where we successfully converted almost 5,000 acres, we averaged $546 an acre. And that's a very substantial investment. Following analysis that I wrote on paper there shows the importance of the tax credit to the economics of this process. Without a tax credit, you've got an initial rate of return of approximately 8.6% and a per acre return at the end of a 45-year rotation of a little over $5,000 an acre. With it and the cost of money and compounding interest, you've got a $10,000 plus per acre return in terms of dollars. It goes from a questionable investment to a reasonably good investment. From our perspective, we're willing to augment those acres into our operation and accept the higher reforestation costs and lower return on investments. So from a company perspective, the tax credit is critical to our conversion of underproductive land. Many of these units would not have penciled out without the tax credit. We strongly feel there are other benefits as well. You know, being a partner in this, what we've done is we've created for every 30 acres of brushfield conversion, we're figuring that we're going to create 1 million board feet of timber out of that. So converting unproductive brushland to 1 million board feet of, or per 30 acres anyway, 1 million board feet of conifer, that's a pretty good goal, and there's a lot of benefits to the state of Oregon in that, as well as just ourselves. You know, the other part of this is the stewardship factor. Whenever you're converting brushland and hardwood-dominated sites back to native conifer forests, you're doing good by creating a forested landscape again. Fish and wildlife do benefit. We've figured that from our participation in this program, we've converted over 8 miles of fish-bearing riparian areas from hardwood and brush back to conifer stocking. And the public does reap the benefits of that investment we've made. And we make it knowing well that with current and projected regulation, we will not harvest a lot of that timber in those areas. And another, I think our last point, kind of our conclusion here. At a time when federal timber supplies are shrinking due to environmental and political purposes, it seems appropriate that we make every effort to increase the productivity of private lands. So from our perspective, the tax credit is working. It's been narrowly defined from that period since 1995. The new redefinition is more constricted and really targets those highly unproductive areas. And the tax credit program is efficiently administered and rewards only people who practice good stewardship. We strongly urge you to retain this program. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Adams, for a very good exposition on the bill from the industry standpoint. Mr. Carr.
Yes. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Shetterly and distinguished members of the House Committee. My name is Donald Carr.
Now, which ones would those be?
Yeah. Appreciate that. Thank you for inviting me here today. I live in Gresham, Oregon, with my wife, Maureen, and together we own 160 acres of timberland in Benton County and Lincoln County. And the interesting part about this piece of ground is what is an old farmstead, and it was homesteaded about the turn of the century. And old Mother Nature is very resilient. And when the folks moved off the farmstead, probably in the 30s or 40s, this ground came back to natural vegetation. A lot of it was, some was timber, a lot of it was brush and old pasture. And so our work was cut out for us when we purchased our properties in 1986. The areas that were of interest to us in getting into production were the old pasture land and some of the understocked hardwood areas, brush areas, salmonberry areas, big leaf maple areas, just a lot of brush, and the very high... This tree farm is in Alsea, Oregon, just south of Alsea, Oregon, about maybe 8 miles. And this is very highly productive ground. It's just phenomenal. We get over 90 inches of rain a year, except for this year. I think it's probably about half that. But we'll get it within the year, I'm sure. And we wanted to get this land into production. And the timber tax credit on underproductive forest land was an incentive for us, and that's why I'm here today, to be in support of this tax credit. We found it to be very helpful. It was an incentive for us to work a little bit harder and to get the land back into production. One of our most recent endeavors, let me back up a minute. We've used this program for about 10 years on small tracts. We're a small woodland owner. And our tracts that we usually convert may range from an acre or 5 acres to 10 acres in size. But our most recent endeavor was, for us anyways, it was a large undertaking. It was 10 acres of brushland on a north-facing slope with a riparian area on a salmon stream. And we converted this over, and most of the material that we got off on from this property was pulpwood, and so the dollars that we got from this were basically paid the logger and the hauler and to pay our harvest tax. And there was minimal dollars left over because most of this was pulpwood. And there was an area right adjacent to the stream that was basically in salmonberry. And one of the concerns from biologists, wildlife biologists, and professional foresters, and the Governor Salmon plan and Fish and Wildlife, state Fish and Wildlife biologist was to increase shade adjacent to prime coho salmon streams and to provide maybe a long-term woody component to the stream. And a long-term woody component would be a conifer. It doesn't break up and dissolve in the streams as fast as alder does. And so we took it upon ourselves to convert a little patch right next to the stream, put it all in cedar. I don't know if the future generations will be able to log this or not, the way things are going, but it's in, within the adjacent to the riparian area. And adjacent to the riparian area, the deer just love this. They love the cedar, and the elk love the cedar. And, of course, the beavers are very indiscriminate. They'll try
and...
And the what?
And the ducks.
Well, and the ducks. Absolutely. Absolutely. Watch those beavers. They'll girdle a larger tree. But we planted that last year in year 2000, and this year we ended up going back and having to replant it again and retube the trees. They all died. It was a bare root type tree, and this year we put in a better tree, a containerized tree. But my point being that in looking at this example and going back and replanting these trees and looking at the impact of the critters having right adjacent to the riparian area and the concerns for our coho and fish and our streams, if we really want to get some nice conifer and big trees to provide shade adjacent to our streams, it's going to take a lot of work. And maybe this bill is too far advanced along for make this suggestion, but I was thinking of possibly extending the maintenance credit a few more years, like maybe 10 or 12 years, well, 7 years anyways, because there's going to be a maintenance problem in maintaining these conifers, specifically adjacent to riparian areas. And so I hope that, if not this year and future years, that the committee would consider extending the maintenance costs option in the underproductive tax credit. But regardless, we are fully supportive of this Bill 2161. And I am very happy to be here this afternoon to share with you my thoughts on this, and I appreciate you inviting me.
Thank you for your testimony. Let's finish this afternoon, that's a signal to everybody else out in the room, with Mr. Falk's testimony.
Thank you.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Shatterly. My name is Ken Falk. I'm a small woodland owner from South Benton County, still, and also a second vice president with OSWA. You'll hear that Oregon Small Woodlands Association does strongly support this, and you'll hear more about that later. But I just want to talk to you as a woodland owner that has used this program, and also as a retired forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I have administered the program as a service forester, and I've seen the benefits of it. I've had the pleasure of being asked back by landowners who have used this to convert pasture land and asked to come back and give them some advice on thinning the forest that they now had created. And so I know the program works. It works well. And it is a tried and true program, and I would urge you to pass this bill and remove the sunset provision so that we can just continue with this bill and not come back every 2 or 4 years and tell you how good it is, because it is good.
Thank you. Just one thing we've had mentioned about extending the maintenance period and increasing the amount of the credit. You all for that, too?
Well, I think definitely as the Oregon plan and such encourage more work along the riparian area, you better do something. To give them some incentive to do it. If they know they're not going to be able to harvest it, then it's for the good of society would be the only reason you'd, and your own good feeling. And I would certainly look at something like that, yes.
Okay. All right. I apologize. We've gone over our time. And, in fact, I'm 20 minutes into my next meeting, but I wanted to give you gentlemen especially a chance to testify since you've come in from out of town. I appreciate you doing that. And giving us a good sense of the real-world implications of this bill. We will continue with this hearing on Wednesday. This will be back on the agenda on Wednesday, so we will be back then, and we stand adjourned. Thank you very much.